Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege to welcome to the Saleri Report an attorney who needs no introduction. He's been with us twice. He came in 2009 and did a great job of helping us grapple with the threat of mandatory vaccines during swine flu. And then he joined us again in January of 2013 when pressure was really on in the exemptions. And then now, again, we're running the risk of declared emergencies. And so I wanted to revisit the topic of exemption rights. And this, you can tell from looking at Alan Phillips's website that this is a topic that is very complex. It involves federal and state laws. It involves the military. He has a list of all the different people who potentially impacted with different legal fact patterns: parents, students, immigrants, military, employees, international travel, schools, agencies, attorneys. It's very complex. And Alan has really become, in my opinion, the definitive sort of authority on vaccine legal exemptions. He has a book, which I strongly recommend, The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions. It's an ebook. He's got 4.0, and I was just teasing him. He's just going to have to keep writing because so many pieces of this body of law are evolving and practices are evolving daily as we speak. He's got a newsletter and a radio show. You can learn all more about it at his website, vaccinerights.com, which is an incredible resource. Alan, thank you so much for joining us on the Saleri Report. I can't imagine how busy you are these days.
Well, it's a great pleasure and honor to be back with you again, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Okay, current legal issues with vaccines. The last time we spoke, you were in particular dealing with the tremendous pressure on healthcare workers to not exercise exemptions and to, you know, whatever. So maybe start with the healthcare workers, but bring us up to date on what you're seeing in this rapidly evolving area of vaccine exemptions.
Well, it's a real interesting, that's sort of the neutral word, I guess, disturbing, maybe more accurate, for what is happening, at least what I'm seeing with it. There are multiple peer-reviewed published medical studies and other mainstream medical sources that tell us that flu vaccines don't work or of minimal effectiveness, or that they can even be counterproductive. I know of at least two studies, or the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota has reported on studies saying, suggesting that if you get a flu shot 2 years in a row, it may actually lower your protection. And I know one other recent study that was looking at teenagers or children in the 9 to 15 year old range, that the ones who got a flu shot had roughly four times the rate of upper respiratory illness compared to the ones that didn't. And I hear this anecdotally from nurses and other healthcare workers all over the country. At this point, Catherine, I've worked with something on the order of around 350 healthcare workers over the last 3 or 4 years around the country, helping them avoid flu shots. And I hear over and over again about how, you know, the first thing they say is, how do I legally avoid the flu shot? And the second or third thing is that they never get the shot and they're never sick. It's always their peers who are getting the flu shot, who are taking time off because they're sick. And
right.
It seems like the shot is maybe counterproductive, but even worse, for the last 25 years, the federal government's been paying out on average about $115 million a year because of people who are injured and killed by vaccines. And as a quick side note, but a very important one, even people from the CDC and FDA have said that only 1 to 10% of those serious vaccine adverse events ever get reported at all. But in recent months, over 60% of those payouts now are going to people who are injured or killed, or families of people killed by influenza vaccines. So this aggressive push for vaccines, for flu vaccines, in and out of the healthcare arena, but in the healthcare arena in particular, seems first of all to be completely unsupported by the science. And so just very disturbing on that level. Now, I think at one level, this is coming from the Department of Health and Human Services. They have their Healthy People 2020 initiative, and two of their many goals are, first of all, to vaccinate 90% of healthcare workers with the flu shot by 2020, and then a separate goal to vaccinate 80% of the rest of us by 2020 annually with the flu shot as well. So there is a clearly stated agenda as being very aggressively pursued. So for the last 3 or 4 years now, every year, there seems to be a new wave of hospitals around the country who get on board with a mandate. I don't know if ultimately all of them or most of them will go to mandate or not, but as we approach 2020, each year, a whole another wave of them jumps on board. So I've seen the last 3 years, and again, this fall, a jump in my work in this arena because of many healthcare workers at one point or another during the fall being given a deadline, get a flu shot by this date or you're fired. So I'm seeing it more and more every year because of new hospitals or more hospitals coming on with a mandate. So that's sort of a real quick, I think, overview of what's going on in that arena. Where it goes to from here, of course, we'll just have to see how it plays out.
I know, Alan, it's, you know, what an individual person can do, whether they're a healthcare worker or they're just a parent or a citizen, very much depends on state law. Under non-emergency status. So it's very hard to generalize about, you know, how somebody can find and exercise their exemptions. That's why I really always encourage everybody to get your book, because it's a very granular issue. But my impression is there are many exemptions that people can exercise if they know about them. And I know the practice is to push everybody to get vaccinations, but there are exemptions and there are lots of things you can do. Is that not the case?
Well, it's particularly confusing, I think, in the healthcare arena, because the state exemption laws, with only three exceptions that I know of, apply to students, and they don't apply to healthcare workers. So somebody from Texas, say, contacts me and says, well, my state has religious and philosophical exemptions, but my employer is ignoring them. And my right. response to that is, well, that's because they don't apply to employees, they apply to students. So right. in the workplace, we're actually most of the time dealing with federal civil rights law. And this is part of what enables me to work with people around the country, even though I only have a North Carolina license, because anytime I'm dealing with federal law, you know, there's no such thing as a federal law license. Attorneys are all licensed in one or more states or territories. And so we can all practice federal law. So this is right. what enables me to work with, you know, clients around the country, because even with state religious exemptions, you're still dealing with constitutional rights, which is federal law. So, but the
Alan, is the pressure from large corporations or is it the small employers too?
What I'm seeing in my practice right now is mostly hospitals and a really interesting and potentially, I think, disturbing thing that I've seen that I wasn't expecting or looking for at all. A significant majority of my clients report to me that their hospital has either just been bought out or is being bought out or is about to be bought out. There's a rapid consolidation going on around the country right now in right. this arena. And I'm not clear what it's about, but surely one consequence is that decision-making authority is being pushed up, so there are fewer and fewer people making decisions affecting more and more people. And I don't know, maybe you have some insight on that I don't. But
well, I think it's a combination of things, but one of the things is obviously the U.S. stock market has done very well over the last 2 to 3 years, and you know, last year it was up 30%, just gangbusters. The number one best performing sector in that market during that period has been health. So you know, as the corporate PEs rise, there's a real push to go get income. And so, you know, you're seeing a bit of a buying spree. But the other thing is, I think Obamacare is very centralizing. And there's no doubt that the clear pressure is coming from top down saying, you know, get everybody into the digital system so we can re-engineer. You know, you talk to software developers out in Silicon Valley and they think they can knock $1 to $2 trillion out of the labor cost by, you know, turning everything into an app and putting things online. So there's a real push to re-engineer and to corporatize. And you're seeing it not just in healthcare, you're seeing it across the board. You know, the idea that if you standard, I think one of my theories is that, you know, the theory behind Common Core in the education area is to try and standardize everything. And then, you know, then you can get it on software and then you can really corporatize it. So I think, you know, I think it's a combination of things, all of which I would describe as deeply insane. So, you know, but that still begs the question, why? It was interesting. I don't know if you've read, there's a book that was published last year called Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and Forgotten History.
Yes.
It's an MD, you know, goes back and tries to track whether or not vaccines did make a difference into bringing down certain kinds of diseases, and finds no, they really didn't. You know, that happened before the vaccines were introduced. And there's a foreword to the book, which is remarkable, about somebody who's got a kidney unit, and they are noticing that people with kidney trouble are taking the, I guess it was the swine flu or the flu shot, and suddenly getting sick and dying. And they try and stop those people from being given vaccines and end up having a real political food fight. And they're stunned because this has never happened to them before. Whenever they noticed a problem with a drug for kidney patients, you know, it immediately got pulled or stopped, and they tell the story, and it reminds you what a chilling situation this is. So I don't know if you've read it or not, but it's, you know, it's another of many, many, many books that have been written that tries to illuminate the fact that this policy is clearly being driven by an agenda that I don't think is clear.
Well, it's clearly not a health agenda, even though, of course, that's the veneer that's put on it. But it's so, I feel like they are just becoming more and more bold, because the flu vaccine in particular, there's just an immense amount of information that directly contradicts, scientifically contradicts, the policy. And
well, I knew it was bad. I just have to interrupt and tell you, I knew it was bad when I walked into Walgreens the other day. And it was Walgreens or CVS or one of them, but there's a whole slew of these places that are now saying, you know, if you will, for a long time, they offered the flu shot at a cheap price, and then it became free. And I walked in and I said, oh, this is really bad, because they're offering 5 to 10% off on all store purchases if you get the free vaccine. I don't know if you've seen this or not.
I have heard of that. Yes, I have. I don't know if I've
Seen it, and it's scary.
And I was just reading recently about a drive-through at a pharmacy. Now you can drive through and get your flu shot, and it's just really seriously. And I just have to ask, well, what's in those vaccines that they want in our bodies so bad, because they are doing anything and everything they can to, you know, make sure that as many of them are being administered as possible. And I find the whole thing rather disconcerting. But at the same at the same time that, you know, the vaccines are being pushed harder and harder on more and more people, efforts are being underway to whittle away our right to refuse. And this is also another disturbing trend, what's going on at the legislative level. A few months ago, there were over 100 vaccine bills pending around the country, and the vast majority of them were seeking to further the vaccine agenda by requiring more vaccines of children and vaccines of adult populations, and pharmacists being allowed to administer vaccines, and in some cases even allowing children to consent to vaccines, which is blatantly unconstitutional, in my humble but adamant opinion. And yet these laws are getting passed anyway, and restrictions placed on current exemptions to make it harder to get them. And so it's you know, working in both directions, in the sense of requiring more vaccines and making it harder to say no.
Who's financing the effort at the state level? There was just an editorial in Bloomberg this morning about by Michael Bloomberg saying, you know, Washington is gridlocked, and so we're moving out and doing all these things in the states. And here are these different laws I've been trying to get passed, and now I'm financing, you know, doing them and getting them passed in states. So I think it is true you're seeing more of an effort to go to the state level. Who's financing the push to whittle down on vaccine exemptions?
I'm a little bit outside of my area here, but I think probably ALEC, is that what it's called, has something to do with this, you know, corporations working together. Part of this is the structure of the legal system. The federal government doesn't have authority to mandate vaccines for state residents. And so the CDC and ACIP as federal agencies can only make recommendations, and it's ultimately up to the individual states what to do with those recommendations. And there are differences from state to state in terms of what vaccines are required for whom and what the exemption options and procedures are, although there are some categories where you are dealing with federal law, such as in the military or immigration, and in most cases in the workplace.
Right.
So, you know, as you were saying up front, it's a complicated arena. There's just a lot of different parts and pieces to it.
How have any states set it up as mandating the – has any effort been made to mandate – vaccine at the state level other than during the swine flu?
As an emergency vaccine?
On any basis.
I'm sorry, I didn't
Has any effort been made to mandate vaccines at a state level to pass, for a state legislature to pass a mandate that requires all citizens of that state to take a vaccine?
I don't know of any effort outside of I don't know of that ever having happened, and I don't know of any situation where, and I hope I'm not naive in saying this, but I can't imagine any situation where that would happen other than a declared emergency. Although the general goal of, you know, the CDC has had a goal for a long time to revaccinate all adults with all the childhood vaccines, and there are literally hundreds of new vaccines in development. Just a few months ago, I read a figure of over 270 vaccines, new vaccines, that were already waiting for FDA approval or were in clinical trials, the last stages before going to the FDA. We've got this wide open door. The federal government subsidizes vaccine research and development to the tune of billions of dollars a year. State and federal governments mandate vaccines and purchase vaccines, and then the industry has zero liability risk if anybody is hurt or injured or killed by a vaccine. If they are able to get any compensation, it's going to come through the federal vaccine injury compensation program. And so
right.
If you can look at it from a purely cold calculating point of view and throw compassion and empathy out the window, who wouldn't want a piece of that pie? And so the door has been thrown wide open for the industry just to come in, you know, gangbusters and develop as many vaccines and get as many of them required of as many people as possible. So it's really a disturbing agenda in that respect.
Okay, so walk through, I'm listening to you talking now. How do I get information about my state, my fact pattern within my state, what this means to me? Because, you know, this gets very specific very quickly. Talk us through how we figure out what our own personal situation is in terms of state law.
Well, I guess you have to first make a distinction between short-term and long-term needs, or, you know, if you are in a situation, school, work, military, or whatever it is, where you have a requirement that you're dealing with right now, then depending on what the category is, you need to determine what law is going to apply. So if it's a school exemption, it's going to be state law. If it's military, it's going to be Department of Defense regulations, federal regulations, and so forth. If it's a more general concern, like during the swine flu pandemic, I had people contact me and they are asking, what do I do if the swine flu vaccine is mandated? And that's a less precise question because you're talking about a hypothetical event, and mandatory vaccines in the context of an emergency are going to be a whole different game or ballpark, so to speak, legally than routine immunizations. So the first thing you'd have to do to know where to even start the walk as you're saying, walk through, is determine what your starting place is. So if you're dealing with a specific exemption, we figure out which law, state or federal, you're dealing with, and then look at that particular law and the exemptions that are available and the procedure as it's spelled out in the specific situation.
Okay, now, if I get your book, can I navigate, you know, put aside federal emergencies for a second. Other than that, can I navigate through the book and figure out sort of what applies to me?
The purpose of the book, I think, was primarily twofold. First of all, there's a lot of misinformation on the internet about vaccine exemption and waiver law. A lot of very well-meaning people, even some alternative medical doctors and vaccine book authors and so forth, and they just don't really understand the legal parts of it. And so they end up, despite the best of intentions, with information that's kind of a mixture of accurate and inaccurate information. Sometimes it helps people get exemptions, but other times it has backfired on people. So the first point of the ebook was to provide accurate information and in-depth information. It goes much more in-depth than what you'll find in any other source that I'm aware of. And then, in one sense, to help people have enough information to be able to make informed decisions about where to go from there. So, like, people could, you and I think, Catherine, would agree that with regard to vaccines in a general sense, to make an informed decision about whether or not to vaccinate, you need a certain minimal base of information, much of which you're not going to get through conventional mainstream sources. And in a sort of a similar way of thinking, when you're dealing with exemptions, how do I legally avoid vaccines, there's a certain body of information you need to have or to understand in order to make an informed decision about how to proceed with your exemptions. For example, the hardest people for me to help are the ones who try to get an exemption on their own, their exemption request is rejected, and then they come to me.
Right.
Because when people come to me at that point, they've often already done things that are just hard or impossible to go back and fix.
And right. So, it makes it much harder to switch the story.
Right. So if you've read my ebook, you will have a much better idea, for example, of whether or not you need an attorney. And sometimes you don't.
Right.
You know, absolutely. And I don't want, I don't want to take anybody's money who doesn't need my help. But there are other situations where you really are well advised. And going back to the healthcare arena again, what I see in that arena, there are two main stumbling blocks. And the first one is that most hospitals, and I would say, 95% or more of the ones that I've seen in terms of my clients in my practice, most hospitals are just sort of making this up as they go, and they implement unlawful exemption policies. And so they are, right off the bat, excluding people who qualify. And if you have an employer who has an unlawful policy, that's going to be hard for you on your own to deal with because – and there's nothing wrong with trying in terms of getting them to fix their policy.
Yeah, I'll tell the so I'm going to take this side because I'm not the attorney. I think there is something wrong, and that is if you try and do it yourself, you're going to run into the people who are in your chain of command or communicate with your chain of command. Whereas if your attorney does it, then your attorney's the bad guy. He's dealing with their attorney, and there's an avenue to deal with it that will be much less harmful to the relationships within your chain of command. So if I was doing something in the workplace, the last thing I would want to do is do it myself. I would, 9 times out of 10, I would want to use an attorney. I just,
No, I think you're absolutely
right. I'm going to push for the attorney.
Well, I think you're absolutely right there. And what I see in terms of what I hear, at least through my clients, for example, I've had 3 different nurses from different parts of the country tell me that they were told by hospital administrators that the hospital system, so we're talking some group of hospitals, that the hospital system had gotten over 1,000 requests for exemptions. In fact, one said they'd gotten over 1,500 requests. And each time they bragged that they had allowed very, very few exemptions. One hospital that had over 1,000 requests, the administrator said, we only allowed 4. And I don't believe for a second that only 4 out of 1,000 people qualified.
No, it might be that 4 had an attorney.
Yeah, exactly. Or that you know, four were just, you know, for some reason, the classic irrefutable, you know, request. But the hospitals are more often than not are implementing overly restrictive policies that do violate federal civil rights law, at least with respect to the religious exemptions. Where I see them going with medical exemptions, and they're not all getting here at the same place, but they do all seem, I mean, at the same time, but they do seem to all be heading to the same place. And now they're saying you can't have a medical exemption unless you've got a history of anaphylactic shock or Guillain-Barré syndrome within 6 weeks of a vaccine.
Oh, good Lord.
I had a nurse who had three different doctor letters, and the hospital still said, we don't care, get the shot or you're out of here. And it's just, you know, bizarre.
Well, right. No, it's not bizarre because if you look at, I mean, I've seen, and I'm sure you've heard many more stories than I have, but I go back to the foreword that I was just reading, you know, situations where it's irrefutable that these things are going to do real harm, even kill people. And yet the politics are such that you have the bureaucracy insisting that, you know, I mean, this is really sort of, you know, as John Rappaport would say, this is really Hotel Auschwitz stuff. So, and I think, you know, I think we have to sort of face, I don't know, I used to have a pastor who would say, if we can face it, God can fix it. But I think we have to face that. There was one other reason I wanted to push for an attorney. And I just say this as somebody who was a federal regulator working within a very complex bureaucracy. You know, I think it is very important when, for example, you're dealing with a school exemption or that you understand not just the laws and the regulations, but the practices. And somebody who's dealing full time with these kinds of situations has, I'm sure you have an encyclopedia in your head, Alan, of sort of practices here and there and hither and yon. It's not to say that you know all of them, but that is a wealth of information that can really help you in any situation. And I think if you're going to try and get an exemption, you really want to succeed, and you're always better off if you are armed with an expert who has that body of knowledge. And there's no way an individual, you know, unless they're not working and can, you know, steep themselves in this full time and do enormous research, can get that. So, I'm going to make a pitch for experts on this one, because I think when you go in there, you just want to have every possible bit of knowledge that will support you on your side.
Yeah, I mean, it's your point's well taken. You know, everybody, of course, has to decide how important it is to them. And I had a nurse call me once, and I go out of my way to try to make, you know, my services as affordable as I can. But I had a nurse call me once, and she says, what are your fees? And I told her, and she says, well, I think I'll go ahead and get the vaccine. And I said, okay, that's fine. That's your choice. I mentioned that to another nurse, and she says, Alan, you've got to be more assertive. I work with the patients that get Guillain-Barré syndrome from the vaccines. Alan, you do not want to get that, you know, that condition. And, you know, everybody just has to decide for themselves, Catherine,
right.
You know, how important
right.
it is. But I respect any informed choice, whether I personally agree with it or not. But I, at the same time, as I've learned more about this issue, I've been now looking at the vaccine issue for 20 years, and I just find that the deeper I dig, the messier it gets. And boy, John Rappaport, I've been reading a lot of his information recently, and this guy is on top of the issue. I have great respect.
Yeah, he really is. He really is. It's I'm always telling, you know, his wife is a nutritionist and just a really talented I consider her a sort of a natural gifted healer. And I'm always telling her, you know, your husband keeps me sane because he's so, you know, he's willing to call a spade a spade. Well, let's turn to the latest, terror du jour, Ebola, and talk about federal powers, because one of the articles I was reading during the period and inspired me to get you back on the Salira report was, someone claiming that under the laws related to the Department of Homeland Security, that they could mandate a vaccine through federal powers in an emergency. So I said, well, I don't know what the facts are, but I know there is one guy who knows what the facts are. So let me ask you, in a situation where the feds try and assert a federal emergency, or they persuade the states to assert state emergencies. What happens under emergency powers, and what are our ability to exercise exemptions in those situations?
Well, Catherine, this question first came up for me during the swine flu pandemic, and I had just not had anything prior to that to bring to my mind to my attention what I now recognize to be a potentially vast difference between our rights in routine times compared to rights in a declared emergency. And what we saw during the swine flu pandemic, I think we can learn a lot from that about what might hypothetically happen with Ebola or any other future infectious disease emergencies that may come down the pike here. And first of all, the starting place, which is very disturbing for me, is that once an emergency is declared, the legal landscape changes, and potentially radically. The rights that we have during routine situations can, at least temporarily, all go out the window in a declared emergency. And we saw a lot of bizarre things going on during the so-called swine flu pandemic. I mean, my understanding of what happened was that the World Health Organization changed the definition of level 6, which is their highest level designation for a pandemic, over the objections of several countries. When they did that, it triggered contract clauses between pharmaceutical companies and countries around the world for the sale of over $18 billion worth of swine flu vaccines, most of which ended up never even being administered. We threw out something like $260 million worth of vaccines here in the U.S.
Wait a minute, Alan. Say this again. I really want to understand this carefully. You're saying that when the federal government declared an emergency, it automatically triggered automatic purchases to the tune of $13 billion?
When the World Health Organization declared a level 6 pandemic, that declaration triggered contract clauses between pharmaceutical companies and countries around the world for the sale of $18 billion worth of vaccines. Now, this comes from Dr. Wolfgang Wodarg, who was a German epidemiologist who was the head of the Subcommittee on Health of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. So this is not a conspiracy theory. This is, you know, about as mainstream a source as you can get. And he went public in early 2010 and said the swine flu pandemic was a hoax. Not that there wasn't a swine flu virus, but this was a very mild disease. It turned out to be much milder than the seasonal flu vaccine in terms of its virulence. And yet, $18 billion in U.S. funds, $18 billion worth of sale of vaccines. And then you had entire countries like France and England purchased enough vaccine to administer a swine flu vaccine to the larger portion of the population, but then ultimately only administered between 5% and 10% of the population's got vaccines. And here in the U.S., we threw out something like, I think it was $260 million worth of expired vaccines. Nobody was getting them.
When did those contracts trigger? What year?
I don't have precise information on that, but I believe the level 6 pandemic designation probably was in 2009, late 2009.
Good Lord.
Early 2010. But so it's, I think the most, in terms of, you know, what do we do if we start having Ebola outbreaks or they are claimed, whether or not they really happen, and emergencies get declared. You know, what I found myself saying when I started exploring the law on this back in 2009 and 10, and people say, what do I do if the swine flu vaccine is mandated as an emergency vaccine? And I found myself answering that question by saying, you do everything you can now to avoid ever being in that situation, because it doesn't look to me like you have rights in a declared emergency. I know of only one state, Minnesota, that has laws on the books that if there's a declared emergency and emergency vaccines are mandated, that you can exercise an exemption. Now, that doesn't mean that if somebody comes to your door with an emergency vaccine and there's no exemption in an emergency, that you have to say, okay, there's no exemption, and roll up your sleeve. At least in theory, health departments are supposed to use the least restrictive means of achieving their goals. So just because they could, in theory, require a vaccine doesn't necessarily mean they're going to force it on everybody. I'm not sure that anybody has legal authority to hold you down physically and inject you, maybe in the military, but not in civilian life. Although, frankly, Catherine, if people are scared, you know, they're going to hold you down and inject you, and you can complain about it later. So I am concerned about the...
What are their enforcement powers under the law?
It's going to vary state to state because it's going to be a state law issue, but all states are going to have the ability to quarantine people who have been exposed or at risk of being exposed, or to isolate anyone who has symptoms. They really do have broad authority to deal with these measures, short of, you know, holding people down and injecting them with a vaccine they don't want. You know, if somebody shows up at my door, I'm going to explain that it's against my religious beliefs, because it is. I'm not going to say, oh, you got me, because I know the law and I know I don't have a right to refuse. And I'll just say, look, I'm happy to quarantine in my home as long as you need me to. And I'm sorry, I can't get a vaccine. So there are ways to get out of this. And if I may, Catherine, just a quick note or two about religious exemptions, because a lot of people hear that phrase and they say, oh, I'm not a Christian Scientist, or I don't even go to church, I can't have a religious exemption. What qualifies for a religious exemption has to do with the way the law defines religion for legal purposes, and it turns out to be incredibly broad. You do not have to be a member of any organized religion at all, and it doesn't matter which one you belong to if you do belong to one. You can be Catholic, Buddhist, Hindu, Islamic, or no organized religion or no mainstream religion. It's your personal religious beliefs or your personal interpretation of whatever your religion is. So as a starting place, it's a really broad, broad door. Where it gets tricky is if you're in a situation where you have to state your beliefs and then the authorities have authority to scrutinize your beliefs. And sometimes that's the case and sometimes it isn't. It just depends on what situation you're dealing with. But if you have to state your beliefs and they can be scrutinized, that's the situation where I recommend people get up with an attorney who has experience in doing this, because the way the law works on that part is just not consistent with most people's common sense approach.
Right.
But that starting place is a wide open door.
Now, when the emergency is declared under the law by the World Health Organization or by the federal government?
Well, I mean, emergencies can be declared at any level, right on down to the individual county level. During the swine flu pandemic, there were some individual counties around the country that were declaring a local emergency in their county. Once an emergency, as I keep saying, once an emergency is declared, the legal landscape can change. There was a case, I forget where this was, it may have been New York, but there was a case in any event where a child was given a swine flu vaccine over the mother's objection or without the mother's permission in school. The mother sued and she lost the case because there had been declared a state of emergency. And I think in that case they were referring to the national emergency that Obama had declared. So we had Obama declaring a national swine flu emergency. We had, I think, about 11 states that declared state emergencies. The state of Virginia, by the way, declared an emergency without having documented a single case of swine flu anywhere in the state. This is how trigger happy these people are. And I have read that the governor of Connecticut has already declared an Ebola emergency in Connecticut, to which you just have to really scratch your head and say, what's going on here?
But here's my question. Can the World Health Organization declare an emergency that has legal or is controlling legally overriding state law?
The World Health Organization's jurisdiction is really more on the international level. For example, there are international health regulations from the World Health Organization that dictate who has to get vaccines to do international travel and in what circumstances and so forth. I don't think they have authority to reach into the jurisdiction of any individual country and affect what's going on there unless they are invited in. So there are different levels of authority going from local to state to national to international. And it's going to depend on circumstances. You know, if there was some sort of Ebola emergency at an international airport in Kansas, that might be a situation where multiple levels had jurisdiction simultaneously. It's an international airport. It has international implications. Maybe that would trigger jurisdiction for the World Health Organization. It's clearly within the U.S. and if it's involving a plane that has crossed state lines, then maybe it's got federal, there's federal jurisdiction, and then it would obviously be state and local jurisdiction there as well. But any situation that starts with a single jurisdiction, you know, if there's some issue, some emergency occurs fully within the state of Tennessee, then that's going to be a Tennessee matter as long as it doesn't cross state lines. But if the Tennessee authorities want to invite in the CDC or hypothetically, you know, World Health Organization or what have you, I think they have authority to do that. And so it just sort of depends then, you know, on what the specific situation is, and then perhaps later who brings in who else because they want their help or assistance.
Once again, you are proving my point that you are well served to have an attorney. I just think this is going to be a very, you know, this is going to require great precision, and it's going to change situation to situation and state to state. So to a certain extent, we're in uncharted territory. So, so explain to us, Alan, how we stay current with your work, how we find your website. Let's go through it again. Your website is vaccinerights.com. It's excellent, very clear, very coherent, very easy to navigate. Your book is the authoritative guide to vaccine legal exemptions. The ebook is just out, the revised one. You've got a newsletter we can sign up for. We've got tell us about your radio show, because that's relatively new.
Well, I have a couple of radio shows. I do their internet radio shows, so anybody in the world can listen in to the live shows or look at the archives, listen to the archives whenever it's convenient for you. So wonderful convenience what you can do now with radio on the internet. It's a Monday night show, 9 p.m. Eastern time, 6 Pacific time. I co-host that show with Dr. Mayer Eisenstein. Dr. Eisenstein is a wonderful human being. He's had a medical practice for the last 40 years. It's been a non-vaccinating medical practice, but he also has a law degree and law license, and so I can actually talk shop with this guy, and is among the few medical doctors that I can do that with. Something about the I love, you know, Mayer is one of my favorite people on the planet, so I'm not anti medical doctors, and many medical doctors, a growing number of them, frankly,
are very concerned.
Yeah, very concerned about the issue, and I love them all, but there's just something about that medical license and medical degree that makes you an expert in everything. And Mayer, I just say I love the guy. It's we've been doing that show a couple of years now, and we both love it. It's terrific, and people can call into that show and ask questions. It's on blogtalkradio.com, and it's also rebroadcast on at naturalnewsradio.com. It's called the Know Your Rights Hour. And the newer show that I've just been doing this year for a few months now called The Vaccine Agenda. Now, I host this one by myself, and it's on Tuesday evenings, 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 Pacific. And this one is really more narrowly focused in the sense that I have every show that I can, I have a guest who has a personal vaccine adverse event experience with their children or themselves, sharing their experience, because I really want to drive home to people how real and personal this issue is. You can't unvaccinate, and once you've had that adverse event, it can have lifelong implications and very profound ones. So we try to underscore that. I try to also have an expert guest on every show. It could be a medical doctor or a PhD researcher or a vaccine book author. sometimes alternative, so-called alternative complementary folks, you know, chiropractors and others, but people who are knowledgeable about the science or politics and vaccines. And then as time allows, I finish every show talking about some legal aspect about the issue. So try to pack that show tightly to cover a little bit of a lot of important things there. But folks are always welcome to email me with their questions about vaccine legal issues, or if there's something they want to see addressed on the radio shows, they're welcome to email and say, hey, please talk about this or what have you. And on the Monday night show, people can call in and ask questions anytime.
Now, I also saw something on the website that I'm not familiar with that I think might just say a few words about, called the Pandemic Response Project.
When I learned back in 2009, 2010 that rights and emergencies are very different from rights outside of emergencies, I formed what I called the Pandemic Response Project. Because what I discovered is what I mentioned just a little bit ago, Catherine, that in most states, if there's a declared emergency and an emergency vaccine is mandated, you don't have an exemption law that says here's your right to refuse. And that concerned me deeply. I've even seen a couple of state laws that threw medical exemptions out the window in some emergency situations. And again, just find that very disturbing. So the goal of the Pandemic Response Project is to support people in being legislatively active, primarily at the state level, because there are certainly issues at both state and federal level, but I think the primary place where the rubber meets the road on the vaccine issue generally is in the state legislatures. And the primary focus being on getting laws passed that give people the right to refuse emergency vaccines, because as it turns out, that's a separate issue from exemptions to the routine immunizations.
Right. Right. Well, I think that's a very good effort to support, and I appreciate everything you were doing. Well, Alan, it has been an absolute, well, I can't say the topic is always a pleasure, but it's wonderful to know that we have excellent attorneys who are out there making sure that people who are interested in exercising their exemptions understand what's available and how to go about the process. So this is just a remarkable service that you provide, and I can't thank you enough. And given all that you're doing, I can't thank you enough for taking time to be on this O'Leary Report.
Well, again, Catherine, a pleasure and an honor. And, you know, given the incredible work that you do, I'm just really delighted to have someone like you in my court here, and I'm certainly in yours as well. So thanks for all that you do as well, too.
Okay, you be blessed. Have a great day.
All right, you too. Take care.
Thank you.